right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to A Tribe of One. My name is Ankit. I am the co-founder and CEO of Sapien, and I'm here with a very special friend today.
I'm Rob Giamatti, co-founder and chief product at Sapien. Happy to be here.
All right. So this is a podcast where we talk about communities that we've been a part of, communities where we belong to today, and communities that we can only dream about. Usually, we'll have an interesting guest on, but for today, episode zero, we'll just do it with your two co-hosts, Ankit and Rob. So let's dive right into it. So I guess to get started, maybe Rob, you want to do a nutshell introduction of yourself and maybe a little bit of your background?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Rob Giamatti. Ankit and I met at UC Berkeley freshman year. We were both studying engineering. Always sort of been somewhat of a inventive person, you know, got into engineering via doing robotics in high school. Always been really interested in technology, the future, dreaming big and trying to build crazy things. So that's how we got into Sapien.
Yes. Yeah, it's been an incredible couple of years. And, you know, just to sort of take it way back, you know, I'll share a little bit about myself too. You know, I came to the United States from India when I was 4 years old. Family was just following the American dream. And yeah, just always been fascinated with technology and its ability to have such a positive impact on the human condition. So just been absolutely sort of enchanted with being able to build and utilize new technology. And, you know, that's one of the reasons I got into computer science too, because it was just one of the easiest ways to build something of value. And yeah, I think Rob, we've known each other for what seems like an eternity now, but, you know, honestly, it's only been like 8 years. And I still remember, you know, the first day I walked in the Foothill dorm, and I saw you with your long hair and, you know, it was just I was like, who is this kid? And it turned out we would start a company together and, you know, go places. So it's just been an incredible journey. And, you know, I'm just so sort of grateful to have been able to do it with you and so many of the other great team members that we have on Sapien. But yeah, so, you know, bringing it back to robotics, tell me a little bit more about, you know, some of your early days building robots.
Yeah, so I joined robotics my junior year, got into it through a good friend of mine, Teja, from high school. Yeah, that was really my first introduction into engineering, as I was saying. And yeah, really an amazing opportunity to really build things. You know, it sort of feels like Legos, and there are even some Lego robots now, but it's quite an amazing experience to be able to just put something together, write a few lines of code, and see it go on its own to do incredible things, you know, or even just simple things. I remember we had a whole lot of trouble figuring out a simple wall follow code for one of our projects senior year. It took us hours and hours writing line and line after code and trying to dig through it, debug all the errors just to get a robot to do something as simple as follow a curved wall. And it's really amazing how much effort and how much deep understanding has to go into simply getting things like that done.
Yeah, do you remember which sort of robotics kit you were using? I remember when I was doing it in high school, I used to have the Lego Mindstorms, Lego Mindstorms 2.0, and then the NXT after that. But do you recall? Like, you
know, we were using the Vex robotics kit. So it's maybe just a little step up from the Lego, but not quite the super intense machine shop style of robotics where you're just with the Vex, you're sort of just screwing things together, you know, and maybe occasionally whipping out the Dremel to cut things into shape. One of the main things about the robotics competition was you had to get your robot to fit into a like 3-foot by 3-foot cube before every competition. So there are many times where we were furiously like shaving away at it with the Dremel before getting into the competition.
So. Nice. You know, I too was in the, you know, robotics club, you know, actually all the way back since fifth grade. So, you know, in fifth grade, we used to have this really just amazing teacher, Mr. Sanders. You know, he would stay after school with the kids and host robotics club. And this guy was really passionate about teaching kids, you know, how to build robots. And he was just into it. But we used to, you know, build these little robots, used to follow the Mindstorms guide, and then we would get creative with it, build all sorts of additions and, you know, swap out the wheels for treads. And then we would, you know, we were playing a lot with that. And even in through middle school, when we started to work at or compete with the FTC tournaments, those were actually battle bots. So we were using those Lego kits to actually take down other robots. And I remember, like, you know, one of my favorite memories was, you know, when I joined the team and, you know, we were building the robots together with, like, you know, 9 other friends. No one really knew what they were doing, but everyone was kind of adding in a piece or two. And then we would go to the tournaments, and the way that the rounds were structured was that there would be a 30-second autonomous period where you would have had to have pre-programmed your robot to basically do some commands, try to get some points, make some sort of attack maneuvers on the other robot. And then there would be 2 minutes of driving. So, you know, that was like my first introduction, you know, to just, you know, autonomous design in the beginning. And the way we would code it was we would actually drag and drop blocks. It was actually very similar to, like, you know, something like Snap, where we would just drag the block in, turn, go straight, take a left, go right. There would all just be blocks. And I remember I was just a wicked driver. You know, when it was a 2 minute time to drive, I was like ready to go. And I was like, you know, Ankit's got this, step back. And I was like, no, so
I wasn't a great driver, but I was always in control of the autonomous routine. That was sort of my specialty. It was interesting because we sort of had a very different approach from most of the other robotics teams out there. You know, a lot of them were focused on really optimizing their driving routines and, like, strategizing what's the best way to win the game, right? Because all of these robotics competitions are trying to, like, win a simple game, put some balls in a hoop or something like that. We were much more focused on the engineering side of things, like really studying the design, you know, looking into analysis of stress on our mechanical parts, looking at, you know, the curves of how certain pieces would respond to stress as we would torque them. And that was sort of something that really inspired my love of engineering and really studying deeply how things work and bringing in the math and physics side of things.
Yeah, that's so cool that, you know, you had that experience in high school and actually going very in depth into some of these concepts. You know, I remember as to when I got into programming, you know, I actually did not have much experience at all before I came to Cal. The only thing I had was AP Comp Sci in high school. And, you know, in that, it was a fun experience, but, you know, we were just throwing Java and, you know, the teacher would only, like, lightweight teach, but it was just such a sort of, like, I didn't realize the actual power of coding, right? And how powerful, how software was eating the world, right? We hear this from Mark Andreessen, but at the time, it was just like simple games. You know, we'd make simple things like tanks where we would, you know, shoot projectiles at opponents. We'd make Pac-Man. And we did another Pac-Man back in Berkeley in CS188 for the AI class. And that was more interesting than the high school.
Is that your first exposure to AI?
Yes, 188 at Cal, where we had to do the different sorts for searching through the map, where we did the breadth first search, depth first search, and then ultimately realizing the A star search is the optimal search, where we have some heuristics and we can, you know, Pac-Man kind of knows where he needs to go, where his objective is. That was truly when I understood, like, wow, this could be really powerful. And, you know, it was just the surface level. I didn't take 189 machine learning like you did. And I'm curious, maybe we can talk about that later some point, but, you know, how was your experience there?
So my first exposure to artificial intelligence was in another high school class. We had this special topics in computer science class where we were sort of studying interesting topics in computer science and different applications, right? So we ended up building a chess AI. We had a couple teams of two and we're building chess programs to compete against each other. It was a really fascinating experience. And, you know, it really shows the gradient, like how much variation there is within artificial intelligence. Like what we're doing is technically, I guess, artificial intelligence, but it could be as simple as just like, okay, if this happens, if the knight moves here, we're going to do this, right? So it's interesting to think about that versus machine learning, right? Where programs are basically learning by themselves without interference and without like instructions at every instance, you know. And I think there's sort of a misconception maybe around artificial intelligence in that regard. I don't think machine learning has yet sort of crossed the cultural divide. When people think about safety from AI, for example, there's maybe a lot of people out there thinking that, okay, we can just sort of program in some laws of robotics, right, to prevent it from getting out of hand, but that's really not the case. These algorithms, you know, are pretty much black boxes, and even the most advanced researchers don't really understand what's truly going on at the deepest levels of it.
Yeah, no, I want to take that and run with that thread, because I think that was one of the sort of main motivations when we started Sapien 2, that we saw what these algorithms were capable of on social media, right? The way that they were polarizing and provoking and ultimately lowering our capacity to solve problems in a very, very real way. And, you know, what we see is that when you sort of deploy these algorithms, right, without sort of fully understanding the scope of them or, you know, how they will, you know, what are the unintended consequences, they can really sort of slip away from us. Right? And we saw that. We're seeing that with social media. And, you know, I'm really curious about what sort of safeguards we'll put into place in the future where we can actually, you know, test it and do the risk analysis before we just put these systems out in the wild.
So. I think pulling that back to topic of our podcast here, you know, tribes, right? I think there's really an interesting divide here in society. And it's sort of along the lines of whether or not you believe that technology can solve all of our problems, or if we really need innovation in our social structures to truly advance, right? There's sort of two camps, right? Maybe the techno-futurist camp that believes that maybe we'll just merge with AI to solve all our problems, right? And there's really not necessarily a future for humanity as a species as it exists. And the other crowd, which I think is sort of nascent, but is trying to find a path forward that doesn't look like sacrificing our humanity to the machines.
What would be your preferred path, Rob?
You know, at Sapien, we're all about humans first. So that's, I think, very evident of my position there. I think there's a lot of progress to be made in terms of social organization, social structures, and really the blockchain community, I think, is all about this, understanding better ways to coordinate across the entire world, you know, really truly building transnational systems of coordination to help us achieve our true potential.
Yeah. I mean, Rob, there's so much there that we could almost extend that out to another whole podcast. And it's one of the reasons why we started this podcast, to really explore these type of topics with some interesting people. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned blockchain, right? So I do want to kind of circle back and maybe share with all of you one of my first sort of experiences with this chain, right? So this was actually in Foothill, freshman year at Berkeley. And I won't say who it was, I'm not going to name any names, but there was someone on our floor that was accessing Pirate Bay, right? And that's the first time that I saw Bitcoin. And I was just blown away with just how powerful this technology is. The fact that it's, you know, exists without any nation state backing it, the fact that you can just move it with minimal transaction fees. We're talking billions and billions of dollars can be moved for just a couple of bucks. And the idea that there doesn't have to be some divine authority or government behind what we call money. And when I first read the Bitcoin white paper, after I saw it in usage on the, it was Pirate Bay, right? No, Pirate Bay was the P2P
site. Oh, you're talking about the Silk Road.
I'm talking about the Silk Road, right? Yeah, no, when I saw it on the Silk Road, it was just like, wow, this is extremely, extremely powerful. And obviously you would need some currency like this to actually, you know, to do what they were doing there. And then we kind of stumbled in, and, you know, I remember sharing early with you and, you know, some of our friends, Nishant, you know, that I was investing into Ethereum and Bitcoin even then. And then, you know, when Ethereum came out and I read that you could build entire applications on top of the blockchain, that's when just things started, you know, lighting up, you know, for both of us. I remember, you know, it was amazing what we could create in a way that was decentralized and could preserve sovereignty and could ultimately empower people at a scale that, you know, has never been done before. So, oh yeah, I want to also get your thoughts
on this stuff. Yeah. I think that touches on an interesting point. And, you know, the Silk Road is sort of a part of the history of blockchain, right? It's sort of the the first use case to really take off, you know, and highlights something within the community, which I think is ties back to that point, you know, where we're transacting without any authority stepping in the way, right? So there's, I think, a really strong libertarian streak in parts of the crypto community. Mm. And I think there's sort of an interesting, I don't know if it's a divide or just a difference of opinions between people working in this space, right? Whether or not the future looks like some crypto anarchy where everything's for sale, there's no rule, no laws, or whether we can use these tools to help develop more powerful governance, right? To really effectively collaborate and coordinate.
Mm, yeah.
Maybe they aren't mutually exclusive, but...
Yeah, there's so many directions I want to take this in, but given this podcast, I think it's important for me to ask you whether you feel like you belong to the libertarian camp, and is that your tribe?
Mm, you know, that's a tough question. I think I do identify with it to some extent. You know, I'm pretty liberal socially. I believe people should be able to do really whatever they want. But, you know, that sort of crosses a few political divides, and it's sort of a sensitive topic depending on what issue you're looking at, right? Gun control. I believe people should be able to own guns, you know. Mm. But I also believe people should be able to have abortions. So there's I think, a lack of representation for people who feel that way in the U.S. And I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on,
you know,
where we are politically.
It's such a tough topic. I mean, it's such a politically charged time right now. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that a majority of people are still fairly moderate, right? And what we see is that the people and the sort of media that is covering, they're covering at the extreme ends, right? So, you know, as far as I see it, like, that's not really truly representative of the average American even, right? I feel like, you know, people aren't so black or white. I think there's nuance to things. And, you know, in a sort of desperate attempt to monetize attention itself, right, we're seeing that the media is forcing these sides to just coalesce and further polarize against each other, because ultimately it drives outrage, it drives sort of more engagement. And, you know, I think something like this requires more sort of conversation. I think, you know, one of the sort of communities that I've been thinking a lot about, which would be nice to see in the future, would be around communities that are willing to have these difficult conversations, right? People from, you know, for example, Black Lives Matter and, you know, the alt-right, right? Can we get actually two of them in the same room and trying to have a productive conversation? What would need to be the prerequisites and the tools to actually enable something like that to be successful, right? That's what I wonder, if we can ever get to that state, because that's really when we can be truly collaborative and, you know, create new sort of value, new discussions, and new sort of vantage points to assess the situation that we're all in. But yeah, curious to get your thoughts here.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like sort of an open question whether or not we will be able to bridge this chasm that we've created as a country. You know, I think we've really never been so divided in recent memory, and I think it's going to be really hard to bring people back together, even if we do share a common footing on a lot of things. But I think there needs to be some innovation in the political sphere. So I'm interested, what's your new political party look like if you were to launch one?
Wow, what a question. What a question. I'm so glad we're launching this podcast. New political party. It would be the radical centrist. We're just radically looking for middle ground. Whatever the middle ground is, we're going to look for synergy and just pull the best from both sides and just push it forward.
Have you seen the Political Compass subreddit?
No, I haven't.
Oh, okay. I've got some great memes. And for everyone who doesn't know, it's sort of a meme group about dividing people into the four political quadrants along the authoritarian versus libertarian perspective and the left versus right. So the joke in there is that the radical center is sort of just the average dad who's like flipping burgers on the grill, you know? And I think that touches on an important point, which is, you know, however silly it is, like, yeah, there's a few things that unite us, which is like grilling around a fire. It's really hard to come together when we're sitting around a fire. And,
you know, Rob, I want to take this conversation in the direction that I know many people have been waiting for, right? And they will be waiting for it in the future. I'm projecting out of the future. This is the part that's interesting, right? The campfire. The campfire, Rob, because you bring this up with food, and food is such a, you know, uniting sort of experience for so many of us. And as a Punjabi, you know, food is number one, right? So, you know, when we talk about sort of tribes that we've been a part of, right, I want to ask you, and I want to share a little bit, you know, about myself too, but I want to ask you about your experience camping and sort of the experience of sitting around a fire. I don't know, maybe you can, you know, talk about something there. Yeah.
You know, so I'm not really a religious person. I don't really have anything to fall back to there. And, you know, it's really sort of hard to find meaning in today's society, especially when you're constantly bombarded with terrible news, terrible things going on all across the world. But, you know, there really is something sort of spiritual about sitting around a fire, especially out in nature. I really love to backpack, and there's something truly incredible about just sitting around a fire and staring at the stars. You know, really gets you back to your roots. You know, it's everyone's shared history.
Yeah, no, it's just so incredible. You know, I you might laugh at this, Rob, but you know, I didn't quite get into camping until I became a Boy Scout. So, you know, I worked my way up. I became an Eagle Scout, and you know, that's part of who made me who I am today. But you know, the sort of experiences that I had as a Boy Scout, you know, just camping with friends up all night, telling stories, you know, sitting around the campfire, cooking meals, you know, having our little propane tank, cooking spaghetti. It was just slightly undercooked all the time. Yeah. You know, those sort of memories, I just can't ever forget, right?
Because
you're saying that unifies us all, right? It's you know, and you're talking about religion, right? We'll even go there. This podcast is all, you know, it's everything, right? So we, you know, when I say we, I grew up in a religious household too, right? And I grew up as a Hindu. And, you know, the idea of God is so deeply ingrained in me. And it's meaning, right? It's purpose. It's something higher to look up to that sort of lets us sort of move away from the fact that everything is so finite, right? That the whole human experience is bound to end, but there's something higher that is worth aspiring towards. And, you know, I firmly believe that everyone should act as if there were a God. And, I think conceptually that's resonated a lot with me, because ultimately make for better morals and a better society. That's not to say you atheists have no morals.
I don't know if I'd call myself an atheist. More, oh, maybe
tell me more. Tell me more. Yes, tell me more.
Maybe something along the lines of a pantheist. You know. You know, I think, yeah, growing up in Colorado, nature is definitely a huge part of my identity. I grew up in the foothills above Denver, so staring down from a few thousand feet above Denver and really staring at that open expanse, it's hard to not have that be sort of an all-consuming presence. But it's, again, really easy to take things like that for granted. And after going to Berkeley for college and later coming back, I really started to appreciate nature more, and really just the mountains. You know, there's something truly majestic about the mountains, and something that, yeah, isn't quite there anywhere else. I feel really lost if I can't orient myself around the mountain landscape, you know?
That's fascinating to me, because as a Californian, for me, it's the water, right? Like, I need to see water once in a while, like hit a beach or, you know, something. I might be a true beach bum in that sense. But, you know, there's something absolutely sublime about mountains, right? The fact that they're just this grandiose thing that just makes us feel so small, and so small in the grand scheme of things. But, you know, I can definitely appreciate the sort of, you know, hiking with good friends and having good conversations. You know, that's what it ultimately boils down to for me. So
never really climbed a mountain until this last summer. I went on a backpacking trip up to Wyoming, the Medicine Bow Range, with a few good friends, and climbed over a summit there, and that was really a cool experience. And even growing up in the mountains, you know, I somehow haven't really climbed all that much. So climbing up a rocky boulder field with a huge backpack on your back really gives you a true appreciation for the scale, especially when falling off of it is always just a step away.
Oh my God. Yeah, no, I mean, I can immediately relate to that. Because I too, you know, was in scouts, we were hiking with these ridiculously huge bags, and we would go like 6, 8, 10 mile hikes, to our tent. And it would just be this, you know, crazy thing, just a small little, like, you know, sixth grader just lugging around this huge bag, the size of him, you know, it was a really good time. And yeah. Now I see why we resonate so much on so many of the things that we're doing at Safe too. That's, it's really great to dive into these. So.
Yeah. It's, funny, I think how much you can know a person without even knowing the details when you resonate on a lot of these levels. But getting back to the campfire and food as a unifying force, I don't know how much you were into this, but Anthony Bourdain was really sort of a huge inspiration for me. You know, growing up, I've really always appreciated travel and really been fortunate to travel as much as I have. But as I've grown older, I've begun to appreciate it even more. And there is something amazing about experiencing other cultures and sitting around the table and just having a meal with people across the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's such a good way to learn about another culture. And, you know, when I sort of traveled abroad to Southeast Asia a few years back, where I went to Thailand, Vietnam, Hong Kong, and Taipei, the food tells so much about a culture. Right. And, you know, when I remember Thailand, I have just so like fond memories of just going out into the street and walking up to street vendor who is selling some pad thai for $2 or something. Right. And it would just be the most delicious meal that I had in my life. Or I'll go wake up in the morning for breakfast and we'll eat like quail eggs. And, you know, it was just something about the way that they made the meal. Just so human, right? That this is what they've been doing their entire lives, and they can make a damn good quail omelet. And you know, it was just some of the tastiest meals I've had. And you also realize how much, you know, when it comes to culture, and America is very beautiful in this respect, but we are a melting pot, a mosaic of sorts, right? Where we're bringing all these cultures together. But when you go to see another culture and it's never been sort of exposed to the American ways, like you'll just see its raw form, right? Like it's the sort of uncorrupted form, right? It hasn't been Americanized. The spice levels haven't been reduced, you know. And it's really just incredible, I think, to eat some of those foods. I did struggle in Vietnam, though. Vietnam, you know, in the morning we would eat these rice bowls, and as someone who likes to eat eggs like literally every day, I just could not eat, you know, rice soup in the morning every day. That was getting to me, but everything else I was good with.
Yeah. You know, I think that's something we can really improve upon in America, sort of the street food culture. You know, it's really incredible to see something so organic. Like, I spent some time in Vietnam as well, and seeing like an alley, you know, just regular old alley turn into like a bustling market basically at night is, quite a sight. And I think we could really use a lot more of that essence in America, you know, that culture around coming around together, which is really so well encapsulated in street food.
Right. Yeah. I remember when the two of us were in Singapore, and there was that one market that was just a few, you know, lanes down from a few blocks down from our hotel. They would open up and it would be so lively. And it was weird because I made this joke even then. I was saying that, hey, like the lower the food rating is, the better it is, right? You know, if it's like, if it's A or, you know, B, like, okay, you got to look for the C's. You got to look for the ones that have the low rating, because that's the stuff that's, you know, just so authentic. And yeah, don't worry about food ratings.
Yeah, Singapore was pretty awesome, and they definitely have a great food culture there. Something that I didn't know before going there, but turned out to be really amazing, was just a fishball noodle soup. You know, it sounds really strange as an American, like what the hell is a fishbowl, but turns out it's pretty good. Definitely try it out if you haven't before.
Yeah, yeah.
One thing I'm sad I missed out on is the Singapore chili crab. Definitely have to go back to check that out.
Nice, nice. We'll have to make another trip at some point.
Yeah.
That surprised you about Singapore. What surprised me was the lack of private property. I don't know if you want to get there, but that was something that
when I
heard about that, the fact that, you know, the government essentially owns so many of the buildings and people can't accumulate wealth in through the form of real estate, that was really shocking for me as an American, because in the United States that's like the norm, right? So many people get wealthy over property, right? And people have been disenfranchised and Black Americans in particular have not been allowed to own property for many, many years, right? Especially when we're talking about, you know, 1940s to 60s, it was tough, right? It was tough. And, what surprises me again with Singapore was that, hey, the government is basically holding this land and they're accruing the wealth from the appreciation of that land. And it didn't quite settle right with me, because I know how much value there is in private property and how it's such an American thing, right? And yeah, wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Well, yeah, I guess it's sort of a global thing, but it's really the housing market's a really strange thing. I think a lot of its value is sort of propped up by regulation and sort of it's a artificially inflated market, you know, with the housing crisis in 2008, we saw that there's a lot of really funky stuff going on with housing, with mortgages, with these strange derivative options used to price housing. But right now, it's apparent that the housing situation in America isn't really doing too great. You know, it's really impossible for young people to find a house right now. You know, a few of my friends are looking to buy a house here in Denver and just constantly are being outbid. So it's not looking very great for people right now. You know, it's definitely far flung from our parents' generation when you could sort of realize that American dream, right? Buying a house, you know, having some stake in something, but it's looking increasingly unattainable. And I think we're seeing that similar trends in like the gig economy, right? Like, and this ties back to crypto, but we're sort of seeing the phasing out of ownership in the economy as a whole, right? And this just sort of rent seeking behavior, right? Like, and as capital accrues into these corporations that end up owning almost everything, right? And are sort of just employing consultants to work for them on maybe a part-time basis without benefits. Really, they're the only ones accruing ownership stake in the corporations and ultimately in the country as a whole, right? So I think there's really something that needs to be addressed there. I know in California, just recently, there was a new law about Uber drivers. I don't know if you have any thoughts on that. I'm good.
Yeah, it was an interesting proposition that I had a vote on too, but it was basically around whether Uber had to reclassify the drivers as employees and not consultants and actually give them benefits. And this was really interesting, because what we saw from a lot of venture capitalists in Silicon Valley is that they wanted to protect the interests of Uber, right? It's their investment at the end of the day. And what would mean making them consultants, right? Whereas a lot of people were saying, hey, maybe these people want some benefits, you know, deserve some benefits, given that they're driving, you know, almost 8 hours a day, pretty much the schedule that Uber sets. So it was pretty controversial. And I definitely saw a lot of ads going both ways. And, you know, the problem with like propositions in general is like, you know, sometimes it's hard to just read it at the surface level and quickly make a decision, right? I wish that there were more in-depth analyses, and you kind of have to dig around to get educated on these propositions. But, you know, ultimately, if there was a way to sort of have more resources to make the sort of right call, you know, I'd be, you know, really appreciative of that. But, you know, I think it's really tough, because, you know, what do you do when multiple sort of when drivers in particular, right? If you really want to get into this, right, drivers in particular, when they're working at different companies like Lyft and, you know, any other sort of delivery services like DoorDash, what's the difference then between an employee and a consultant, right? Because we're seeing those lines being blurred more and more. So if I had to really put some, you know, original thought into it, it was like, you know, maybe they do deserve some benefits, but ultimately they'll have more benefit, more sort of independence as a consultant. And then, you know, if the world is going where we're saying it's going, where people are just going to work at multiple sort of jobs and maybe do an hour stint here, hour there, and sort of use their skill set in that way, then a consultant is a better path for that. And I'm curious, you know, since you brought up the gig economy and the, you know, how that's going with the, you know, in the world, how do you feel about people's sort of skills and being sort of put into different jobs, for example, right? And I think, let me just also preface it with one of my concerns is that you lose a sense of community. You lose a sense of community when you're working multiple jobs, maybe doing in 30 minutes here, 2 hours there in your day, 3 hours somewhere else. Where is the place that you call home, right? Because work, after all, is with, you know, you're spending the most of your time with in work, right? You know, more than 8 hours, and Americans go overboard, right? We're going weekends too. But what, how do you find community in this sort of upcoming era? And not even to mention AI sort of coming up and going to, you know, is going to displace jobs and leave people with more free time. But how are they going to find community in this sort of, in this future?
Yeah, I think there's a few points there. One thing we don't know if AI will truly leave people with more free time. It seems like as the economy has grown right now, people have found ways to fill in the gaps. So, you know, even though we're able to produce so much more than we were 50 years ago, people haven't really reaped all that much of the benefit of that. But back to the gig economy, right? I think there are some nice things about it, unlocking new value for people who may have had homes sitting around or have free time to drive people around or deliver something. But as long as it remains extractive, right? Like as long as there's no ownership stake going to anyone except the corporations, I think it's sort of a flawed system, you know, especially with things like Uber Eats, right? We're seeing Uber Eats charging something like a 30% fee to restaurants, right, for delivery in maybe a small community that was trying to unite around these restaurants, right? Everyone in the community loves these restaurants, goes together and hung out there, you know. Especially with COVID, we're seeing sort of a lot of that value flowing away from where it belongs in these communities to corporations who maybe don't really have an interest in preserving this community, even if they maybe try to say that they do in their commercials.
You know, this is such a great point. And, you know, Rob, I would have to completely agree with you on this. You know, the sort of the, especially during COVID, right? What we're seeing is, you know, mom and pop stores were getting decimated by this virus. The companies that profit off it, the Amazons, you know, they were unaffected. You know, Bezos is comfortable chilling in his home and taking care of all these deliveries because...
Yeah, what is it? $200 million home while he's shutting down unionization. I think that's sort of the dystopian end of what the gig economy can be.
Right.
And, it's amazing how what Amazon is doing there. Well, horrifying, but also amazing.
Yeah, and I think this is going to be an incredibly difficult choice for many Americans to make, right? How do you choose between the convenience of Amazon and actually, you know, going to that hardware store and buying those nails that you need for the house? You know, like that sort of decision, I think is way too heavy for the average person.
You know, this is something we've realized within Sapien, right? Like in business and in consumer products, there's really not much room to make ideological arguments around whether or not something is better. Really, at the end of the day, it all comes down to what is the experience, and the best experience will always win.
Yeah, that's a fascinating conversation. And you know, when we really think about experience, and it just doesn't care for ideology, right? Like if China was offering me a better, faster delivery than Amazon, if there were drones that were coming in and delivering to my house directly, and they were from, you know, some Chinese company, and they were coming in within 10 minutes of ordering, would I prefer that over Amazon, right? And would people prefer that over Amazon? And does experience matter that much that you just disregard all the underlying ideology?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a different question, but you know, this is
at that point comes back to sort of the tribalism question. You know, I think there's a lot of concern around what China is doing, and they seem to be doing some pretty terrible things with the Uyghurs right now. But it's really a multifaceted question here. And it's not easy to break down. It's not easy to overcome people's tribal affiliations, you know, and also just the simplicity of a clean, quick user experience.
Right. Right. It's incredibly complex. And I think the one thing that everyone would benefit from, and I think it's, again, one of the reasons why we wanted to start this, is really doing almost a retrospective on the tribes that we've been a part of, right? And the tribes that we're in today, and the tribes that we want to go, you know, and go and join. And I think it's incredibly telling, because we all get our news from certain sources, and it takes a lot of conscious effort to diversify that and expose ourselves to things that we, you know, might not already believe in, right? And I think that's one thing, you know, the whole confirmation bias, how do we get over that, right? Like, I feel like that's one of the toughest things, because we know the value of tribes. We know that we want to belong in community, but sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's really hard to put new sort of information in front of you and absorb that into your worldview. And it's hard for many people, right? And they find a sense of security by just going with the flow, choosing a few communities that, you know, they identify with, and being comfortable there, right? And they're not willing to be uncomfortable anywhere else, because that is uncomfortable, right? And we just have this sort of tendency to do this. And, you know, I want to see a future where we can be a part of the communities that we want to be a part of, but also be actively challenged and exposed to other perspectives, right? And everything doesn't just happen in silos and echo chambers where you're just getting the same nonsense again and again. And that's the future that I want to build, right? And I think you know, part of what we're doing at Sapien is creating the infrastructure to enable something like this. But yeah, would love to get your thoughts.
Yeah, I think it's tricky because, you know, information doesn't really get to people at an emotional level, right? Really, in order to connect with people's beliefs, really, and connect with them on the level of community, right, and get them to feel a part of something, you really need to tell a story. And I think we're seeing a lot of really examples of that gone horribly wrong in society today, with things like QAnon, right? Like, there's some twisted story, right, at the heart of that, where people are convinced of whatever they're convinced of, but they're all rallying around this shared story, being part of some shared community that's unraveling the truth. And it doesn't really matter what that truth is. All that matters is they feel that they're a part of it. They're in the story. They're in some grand narrative that they've constructed, or someone has constructed, for whatever end. But really, it, I think, points back to the lack of community and the lack of meaning that a lot of people are feeling these days. You know, people want to feel like they're part of something, and if there's nothing for them to latch onto, then, you know, they'll take whatever they can get.
Right. You know, this is something that's really worth thinking about, because, you know, when you mentioned QAnon, it's these people that have just felt that the world is run by these democratic pedophiles and that are, child trafficking. And it's just such a strange distortion of reality that is so unbelievable, right? That somehow has ensnared so many people. And I personally just can't understand how that's gotten so much adoption. But you're right, it's still a community, right? It's still a shared narrative. It's still a sense of, these people know what's happening in the world, and I am also participating in sense making in the world, right? So in a way, the QAnon community is trying to sense make in their own capacity, right? And I mean, so is so many other communities, right? You see the IDW group, right? Where you see, you know, people like Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris, really thinking about things rationally. But they have to dig deep, and they bring their expertise, they bring their credentials, they bring their years of experience in trying to dissect these things. But effectively, they're not doing anything different than QAnon, who's also just another interpretation of reality, right? Now, who's to say who's right or wrong, right? Ultimately, it comes down to, you know, I'm curious your thoughts on objective truth. I don't know if we'd get there in episode zero, but, you know, their intention is not wrong. That's all I want to say. No.
There has to be room for objective truth if we're really going to survive as a species. You know, you can only survive so long off of sheer dumb luck when you don't really have anything to ground yourselves to. So that's the problem we're going to have to figure out. And there's a lot of interesting paths forward to that, whether it's just maybe an AI that's an oracle that will decide what's true for you, or maybe some way of collective sense-making by leveraging some internal value system or other values, currency, something like that, to coordinate people around shared beliefs. And this really goes back to something that we were trying to solve originally with Sapien, which is overly ambitious, like everything we're trying to do, but the fake news problem, you know? Mm. I think that's a really difficult problem to solve, and it really gets to the core of a lot of the issues we're seeing, which is this real ungrounding from truth as a civilization.
Right. And that's terrifying to me, Rob. You know, Rob, I would completely agree with that. You know, that is one of those things that concerns me a ton, right? The fact that we're moving away from objective reality. And I think it's one of the reasons why, you know, Bitcoin has gained so much popularity, right? The idea of consensus, the idea that everything can be boiled down to a few transactions that get committed to a block. And these blocks represent the canonical truth of the state at that time, right? And then these blocks basically get embedded in any future blocks. So you create this blockchain where the history is not up for debate, right? Anyone can just look at it and know the state of the system at any given time. And I think that's probably, I wrote about this sometime back, but I think it's one of the closest things that we've gotten to some form of objective truth through technology. But yeah, I want to hear what you think
about that. Yeah, it's an interesting point. I think truth and value, right, are sort of deeply connected, even though they're, you know, very abstract concepts. And I think this is something we have seen in other places as well, you know, with modern economies, right, and fiat currencies, right, where maybe they used to be based on some objective measure of value, whether or not that value measure made any sense, something like a gold standard. But, you know, past that point, it's really unclear where value is coming from in our economy, right? Like, at the end of the day, it's all dependent on whoever is the authority, or in the case of Bitcoin, whoever maybe controls the majority of the mining power. And yeah, it's all comes back to control, right? And we see a lot of flexibility if some institution or some entity has control over the ledger or the system of value, right? They can exploit it to their benefit.
Right. You know, we saw this with Germany in the Weimar Republic, you know, the hyperinflation of the mark. You know, this was a difficult situation for them, but the outcome of that, where the mark was essentially worthless and worth less than toilet paper, was shocking to me, right, to hear from history. And then what we're seeing in Venezuela, you know, even today, and the inflation that's going on there, we're actually seeing a lot of people exiting the government financial systems and moving into something like crypto. Remember, Venezuela actually had the petro for some time, but people were just still weren't willing to buy and hold on to a government-backed cryptocurrency, and instead still chose to go to Bitcoin. Yeah.
I think this touches back on what we were just talking about before, right? Which is when people really feel disenfranchised, they feel that they maybe aren't valuable within society, right? They're way more susceptible to appeals to authority, to stories with something like Hitler or the situation in Venezuela. It's not all that dissimilar from what we're seeing today in the US.
We just got over the Trump, right? We just did. And I'm just so fascinated with the idea that he is considering starting the Patriot Party and coming back for round two. And I'm just not sure how fragmented the Republican Party is right now, in that, is it actually feasible for this third party to emerge and take a significant share of the market, share of the right, right?
You know, yeah. Kind of hilarious if that did happen, if really Trump was the thing that led to the diversification of political parties in the United States and opened a door. I think that's sort of a lot of why people voted for him, right? As an outsider to sort of cause chaos, to disrupt the existing system and open a new door for people who feel like their voice wasn't being heard. So maybe that's one positive outcome from all of this. If there's a new political party where the door is open for more people to express their views in a meaningful way in the political system.
Hmm. That's an incredibly optimistic take. I just love how that's the silver lining of the cloud. You know, this could be the Cambrian explosion of political parties, starting with the Patriot Party. Mm-hmm. I would love for that to be the outcome and the only sort of lasting consequence of the Trump presidency, because we've seen the negative effects, right? We want to see change. And what we want to see is diversity of thought and an investment into nuance.
You know, yeah, I've thought about this a lot, and I think there needs to be a lot more room for nuance, and you know, thought about what would it look like to start a new political party in the U.S. these days. And something I've been just toying around with the ideas, right? Like someone like Teddy Roosevelt, right, is someone that a lot of Americans can get behind, especially these days, looking at the state of the world with all the climate issues. Someone like that, like Teddy, was a huge champion of the environment, right? Started the national parks, was an avid defender of the environment. So I think stories really are the way we connect with so much of what motivates us, right? And, you know, there's few people in history that really are rallying points, really are able to really present sort of a superhuman figure around which to coalesce our ideas. And wondering if there's any way to leverage that in a good way to take our politics in a better direction.
Right. Yeah, it's that's incredibly deep. And I think for ideas to be elevated to that point, I completely agree with you that they have to be elevated beyond the mere domain of humans, right? And this is why religion has such a captivating effect on so many people, in that you're essentially elevating a set of ideals to some supreme that can't be questioned. And I find that interesting, right? Because, you know, what you're proposing for coordination is essentially stories. And that is not much different from religion, right? The religion has been the story of the tribe for many, many generations now, right? And it's been the tool to coordinate us. And it's plausible and likely that we will invent new stories to help with this coordination. But I'm unsure about the fact that it needs to be rallied behind a single person, right? And the example here in particular ties back to Bitcoin. The fact that Satoshi was anonymous made Bitcoin what it is today, right? If you weren't anonymous, I don't think it would have the same effect. If it was just like, hey, Putin created Bitcoin, I would really be thinking like, would it have as much adoption?
Yeah.
If same thing.
Yeah. Fair point. And I think there's something to be said there, but the fact remains that Bitcoin still does have a central rallying figure, right? He's just sort of a mythological character in the form of Satoshi. And historical figures are sort of the same way, right? They exist in some sense, but they sort of transcend into the mythological at some point, right? Mm. And I think, yeah, it's hard to rally around real people that have real flaws. And right, once you're criticizing and looking for every fault in them, right, it's easy to dismiss them and sort of not feel hopeful that they can really achieve great things. And I think that's one of the major downfalls of social media in its current form, right? By giving us constant exposure to every detail of everyone's lives, basically, right? There's less room for imagination. There's less room for hope for people to achieve big things because everyone is so totally humanized in the worst possible way every living second of their lives.
There's so much there. there's so much there that we might just need to pull that out for a separate episode. So,
what we were discussing, I think there's a real need for storytellers in society today. You know, people to tell the story of the times that we're living through to make it make just a little more sense, you know. And I think that's really been the major success of podcasts, right? And that's why we're only at the beginning of what's going to be a truly incredible explosion in this industry, right? And it's because everyone loves the story. Everyone loves being able to be drawn in, right? And to relate to the people that they're listening to and feel that sense of connection. Mm. And that's something that's hard to find today.
Absolutely, Rob. And even while you were saying that, I was just drawn in to what you were saying and just the beautiful vision that you're portraying of the future, the sort of where we need to go, this sort of place of free expression and ability to come together with people of various backgrounds. I think that to me is just a future worth fighting for and a future worth empowering with tools and software. So I do want to steer this conversation a bit, Rob, to a few things that interest us today, right? And we discussed that. We discussed, you know, the camping, the food, you know, where we come from with our technology background. But what are some of the tribes that you would want to be a part of in the future?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. And I think a very deep one. But yeah, let me just tie it back to sort of where I'm at, right, where I'm coming from. I am an avid video game player. I've spent many, many days of my life playing a lot of video games, right? Was very deep into World of Warcraft for quite a while. And the thing that experience has impressed upon me is sort of the transcendent power of really world building, right? That really, if people with a story and people with a world in mind come together, they can create something that feels every bit as real as the real world, right? And I think in a way, that sort of game and the scope that it was trying to achieve really, in a way, was sort of the first full-scale virtual reality, right? These initial MMOs, right, are creating an alternative world for the people that are playing them. And when you're deep in that, there's an emotional connection to the game, right? To the story that your character is involved in. And that's something that companies can exploit to sell you microtransactions to power up your character, right? Or that they can leverage to really build a truly emotionally investing experience. And I think that form of creation is still in its very early days, and we're going to see a lot of progress there and a lot of amazing new creations. And something that in that direction, in that sort of far future form of that is, right, the power of augmented and virtual reality. And what does the world look like when we're sort of merged in with the digital space and we're always plugged into the internet and everything around us is not only the physical world, but it's a digital layer that we're choosing to live in. And at that point, it's really hard to distinguish from a video game. And I think the powerful thing there is that we have a choice of what world we want to live in at that point, right? You have a choice of what layer of this world you want to exist in. And speaking to the tribes that I want to be a part of, I want to be a world builder in this future virtual landscape, you know, like sharing my vision of what virtual cities or experiences can exist, right? And paint those for other people and help build a shared experience together, just like I had back in the day, first logging onto World of Warcraft, you know?
Nice. No, that's beautiful. And, you know, I'll also take this opportunity to share a little bit about myself too, because I too am a gamer. And, you know, I belong to that tribe. And growing up, I used to actually get, you know, the Game Boy games from black markets in India, because they were much cheaper. And I used to travel from America to India to pick up these games. And, you know, I used to have this version of Pokemon that just couldn't save for some reason. And it was just like, I had to get as far as I could get in one city. And I got pretty far, but it was just like, for some reason, this black market game just could not save. But, you know, as I grew up and I started to play more and more games, you know, got the GameCube, the PS2, you know, the PS3, the PS4, all of them, right? But unfortunately, I'm not a PC player. So for those listening that are PC fans, Ankit's not your guy for that. But, you know, it was just an incredible way to connect with friends, right? At the end of the day, for me at least, no matter what the game was, you know, whether it was Call of Duty or Rock Band, you know, we're playing with friends. And to me, that's what mattered to me, right? Like just connecting with people online, you know, especially for me, because I moved around a lot in high school. You know, I went from living in Fremont to another house in Fremont, in a separate district, and then out into the East Bay. It was difficult. And for me, gaming was a way to stay connected, right? And to build a sense of community. And I completely agree with you, Rob, that's exactly where the future is going. People are going to invest more time and energy into the digital realm because that sort of transcends our physical limitations, right? I can only be in one place at one time. But if I'm gaming and I'm on several different, you know, in several different communities, I can be in constant contact with all these people. And that's just going to be completely augmented in augmented reality, right? And you said that, you know, video games are themselves, the definition of that is going to be so diffused and everything is just going to be a game at a certain point. And we're just going to be playing it, just like we're playing the game of life. I think we're just going to be playing additional games, some of them in parallel, some of them while we're working. Instead of taking a break on social media during work, we'll just, you know, go play a quick round with, you know, a few other friends that are also available. I think that's the future that we want to see because there's a blurring of the reality that we're in and the reality that can be. So that's where I really resonate with you on. So,
you know, something interesting along these lines is I think people really underappreciate the amount of skill that goes into some of these video games, right? Like, and we're just recently starting to see that be diminished with the rise of esports, right? But some of these games really do take a lot of skill, and they're a way to know, you know, show off your skill within your group of friends, right? It's really impressive when you are able to make some of these achievements in games, like getting to platinum and or diamond in StarCraft or Overwatch, or, you know, maxing out all the achievements in a game. You know, it's really there's something there, and it's not all that different from what we've seen in like traditional measures of success, sports, things like that, you know?
Yeah. It's just a different sort of hierarchy that you're competing against, which is really fun. Yeah. I remember crushing my friends in Melee and, you know, just apps. I, one time in my prime COD days, I took down a 1-on-3 against my friends, right? It was 1-on-3 on Nuketown. And I beat them to 75 kills. And it was just three people who actually game. And they just couldn't touch me. And that sort of feeling, that's sort of like those moments where you're just like elevated to such a high degree. I mean, this is what, fuck, even Maslow talked about with the hierarchy of needs, right? Like when you reach certain places where you're just completely in the flow state and you're just locked in and crushing it. I think that's like, to me, those are the moments in life that are really worth living for. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Something like that for me was in Halo 3. There was this awesome cosmetic katana that you could unlock for your character if you got all of the achievements in the game. And it was fucking crazy to get there. You had to do all sorts of things like stick someone from all the way across the map, right? Like shoot three people with a laser, right? In a PvP match. And like that shit took a lot of time and a lot of skill, and I was really proud of getting there.
And that's exactly it. You know, I think we need more, and this is such a, you know, to me, I find a lot of depth in this conversation because this is what meaning is to me at the end of the day, right? Like finding new ways to challenge ourselves and find new mountains to climb, right? And games do this for us, right? In a very visceral way. And I do want to see that flourish in the future, and you know it'll be a beautiful future. So
yeah, I think it will be, and you know, crypto will only unlock more potential there, bringing real value into these games in the form of non fungible tokens and in game currencies, right? Like that's relatively unexplored space, but has huge potential. Looking forward
to it. Could you imagine getting your award and then getting, you know, handful of tokens that you could cash out? I mean, that'd be so exciting. Then you'd have to build systems to like prevent gaming of that and people from just creating all sorts of scripts to exploit that. But, you know, I think that's something we have to prepare for. So, all right. So to wrap up today's discussion, one final question for the both of us to have fun with. When did you realize, Rob, that you didn't belong in a tribe that you were a part of?
This is it's a good question. And, it took me a lot of time to get on the path that I'm on right now. Like, at Berkeley, I started out in engineering, but really never quite felt at home there. Spent some time in physics. You know, I was really inspired by the great physicists, you know, like, and there's something beautiful about trying to discover the deepest secrets of the universe. You know, there's a lot of appeal there for me, and maybe I'll come back to it someday. But, you know, that didn't end up working out for me either. And ultimately, I ended up studying mathematics. And I think that ended up being a pretty good home for me. I'm sort of a generalist, you know. I really crave to understand as many things as I can from as many different perspectives as I can, you know. And math is, I think, a really powerful tool for doing that, for looking at complex systems in different ways and really being able to make sense of them, you know. But when it came time to really, with Sapien, I guess, actually, I was initially deeply involved in the engineering side of things, you know, deep in the code, coding all across the application. But really, I felt there was something missing. And where I ended up there was in product. And I think in a strange way, being a product developer is similar to being a mathematician. You know, it's about discovering the trends, the patterns that reflect across complex systems, whether they're mathematical models or just user experiences, right, that shed some light on a deeper underlying experience or system, right? And yeah, that's when I really realized I was at home in product, you know, and being able to apply my skill set in a powerful way to build things from the bottom up.
Yeah, that's incredible. I think so many of us are trying to find our way in life, and you know, it's there's never one path, right? At the end of the day, you know, it's, you know, for me, when I first applied to Cal, I actually almost came in a reverse order of you, Rob. I actually applied as engineering, mathematics, and statistics. I was like, oh my God, I want to get into statistics. I want to get into data science. I want to get into like this sort of whole sort of foundation that mathematics enables. And, you know, when I started taking classes at Berkeley and really thinking about it, I was really drawn to computer science in particular because of the way that you could just create software that could do things. And it was sort of the lowest effort to maximal impact for me, right? Where I saw that you put in a certain amount of hours and you can get the most sort of output from that, most creation. And, you know, through this time, you know, working on Sapien, starting off actually coding, you know, a vast majority of the platform with you, I learned so much about what it takes to properly build software and how it's not just about writing a few lines of code, but actually making it into something sustainable. And this sort of journey, this growth for me was really, really powerful. And, you know, what I really wanted to get a deeper understanding of was how to take what we create and just send it out into the world. And for me, that was entrepreneurship, because when you look at it from a historical perspective, everyone has always been, you know, the greatest people have been entrepreneurs, right? They're the ones that are inventing new things. You know, we're talking Benjamin Franklin, you know, creating all sorts of gizmos. Like, he was a creator, and we appreciate him for that. And he was also a thinker, right? He would also, you know, be a profound author. Throughout history, it's the people that have created things for use by the rest of humanity that really just captivated me. And I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to do my sort of duty, my sort of what I could contribute. I wanted to contribute that, whatever it might be, you know, and it's yet to be figured out how big that's going to be, right? It could be small in the grand scheme of things, or it could be huge. And to me, I enjoy that sort of uncertainty. I enjoy that not knowing what are the implications of what we're building and creating. So that's how I sort of arrived with entrepreneurship and the sort of motivation to build and grow Sapien with all the wonderful people that we have on our team. So
that's great.
Sorry, I got really into that. I was really, really thinking and reflecting about the things that matter. But you know, that's
yeah. There's a lot there, and I think it's all about, you know, you're talking about not understanding the implications, and there is inherent in building something new, right? You're forging into unknown territory, but you also have to make sure to be cautious, you know, to understand as much as you can to that you're going in the right direction. And that's where I think taking a measured approach, a scientific approach, I guess, can really help.
Yes. Yeah, it's this weird combination of taking the scientific approach, but also being willing to take the leap of faith when it's necessary. And it's yin and yang. It's, you can't have one without the other, but it's the thing that drives everything forward. So with that, I'd like to thank everyone who has listened to us thus far. And we look forward to seeing you for the next episode of A Tribe of One.
See you next time.
Peace.